suited up, aren't we? We're ready to go.
Oh, man, do I feel good. My new shirt fits so well.
Oh, yeah. Well.
So soothing to the skin.
Well, we have, especially for guys doing chemo, right? Because your skin gets a little sensitive and what have you.
It can. And this fits the bill. This is the antidote I need when I have those symptoms, without a doubt.
Also, shout out to our mother, Loretta Daniels, 95 years young. She got her T-shirt for Mother's Day, a little after Mother's Day, but she got it 2 days ago, and she's thrilled also. And she's wearing hers today, she said.
Good.
Yeah.
We're out in force. We
are. We're going to scare the hell out of them. Okay. So we got a fair amount to cover today. I think it's going to be a good show.
Yes.
Yeah, mascots. That's our sports topic today.
Yes, I thought I'd kind of lighten it up just a little bit. And since one of the more popular mascots made the news a couple days ago, the Phillies fanatic, who we'll talk a little bit about, was in the news. And you know what? He got in the news because he picked up a child that was probably less than a year old. Oof. And scared the daylights out of this kid. And
not bad.
I thought, wow. What? This is not an exception to the rule. These mascots are scary creatures.
Well, they are.
I mean, I think any young kid would be frightened by them. But it seems like Major League Baseball and the clubs feel that this is a way that they can motivate families to come to the ballpark because they can subject their children to these mascots.
Well, I think it depends upon the mascot. Okay.
I agree. I mean, there are some very lovable ones. And the typical mascot, I'm sure, in case you've been lucky enough not to be encounter one, is some sort of human body with a ridiculous head. Often the body is bottom heavy. I call it like a Donju pair.
Yes.
Would be the way that you would describe them. That would kind of fit the Philly
okay.
fanatic.
Okay.
So you can find that there are ones that are more considered more human, like Mr. Met. You got ones that are animals. They can be bears, cubs. They can be fish. They can be a moose. They can even be a horse. They can be all kinds of things. And then you got what I call the humanoid ones, the ones that are just kind of just creatures.
Wow.
But the current wave of mascots starts back in the 60s when Mr. Met was introduced back in 1964. But it's interesting to go back and find out if you look at the history of mascots, and I've even got a book with this stuff in it, believe it or not. The mascots go back to the 1910 to 1930 is what I call the golden age of mascots. And mascots were just a little bit different back then. They were actually
humans.
They were real people. They weren't dressed up.
They were real animals, too.
But, yeah. And there were a couple of animals I can point out that were mascots. But back in 1911, and these mascots were basically considered good luck charms. So
yes.
In other words, these mascots, there were basically three of them that are well known. And the reason they're well known is because the clubs that they played for won the pennant and went on to the World Series. So we got one of them called Charles Victory Faust. He was just a normal guy, except that he did have some mental challenges. And he claimed that he went and saw the manager of the New York Giants, John McGraw, and said, "You need me on your team. I will bring you a pennant." Well, they tried him out and realized he had very little skill as a pitcher. However, they noticed that as he hung around, they kept winning.
Huh.
So they continued to through 1911, 1912. There was one period of time where he was at 36-2. Just incredible stats. So, they eventually let him pitch a couple of innings just to kind of satisfy his need to be in the game.
Right.
So he was the Giants' mascot. And the Philadelphia Athletics, managed by Connie Mack, had one called Louis Van Zels, who was actually a hunchback, a guy who had been injured young as a youth and ended up hurting his spine and was a hunchback. So this one was with the Philadelphia A's from 1911 through 1915. And sure enough, the first year, first thing is, you would think, we got two of the greatest managers ever. John McGraw and Connie Mack,
yep,
deciding that they, as part of their, you know, managerial strategy, needed to have a mascot.
Wow.
So this was in, and there were other mascots. There's one other one, Eddie Bennett, who was with the 1919 White Sox, which is kind of interesting because that's the team that basically threw the World Series. So he got him to the World Series. So that was kind of an interesting part too.
Yeah, it's a little colored by controversy, scandal.
Yes. The third one I will comment on was the fact is that there was another one, Ulysses Harrison, who was a young black who they basically gave kind of a derogatory name, the nickname, called him Lil Rastus, I guess, which is it's kind of a politically incorrect term.
Yeah.
We don't hear very often. But he's got an interesting background, because what they would do is they would rub his head before they got to the ball, came up the bat.
Equally politically incorrect.
Yeah, so rubbing a hunchback, rubbing a head. We're not talking, you'd say, yeah, you're right. These are not politically correct mascots. Yeah. What's interesting about this mascot was that for the year 1908, he jumped from the Tigers. By the way, they got popular. There was a bidding war for these little guys. And the Cubs had him in 1908, in which was the last year they won the World Series until most recently, 2016. And guess what? In 1909, he went back to the Tigers.
Oh.
And, of course, we know what happened to the Cubs. They didn't win for over 100 years.
Wow.
So we can just add that to the legend of the Bartman ball and the goat and whatever you want to call it. There's kind of a interesting,
astounding.
We talked about Ty Cobb before in an earlier podcast. When they finally, the Tigers decided to get rid of this mascot, of all players, Ty Cobb befriended this black kid and basically took him back to his home and gave him, you know, various tasks to do and gave him a job for about 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
I thought that was pretty nice.
Yeah.
So that kind of goes, these kind of mascots kind of petered out, you know, by the 1920, 25. The Yankees had one. They had this Eddie Bennett who was born, and he was also a hunchback. He's the one who was with the 1919 White Sox. This guy's incredible. This hunchback, Eddie Bennett, 1919, White Sox,
they
win the pennant. 1920, Brooklyn Dodgers, he goes to. They win the pennant. 1921, he goes to the Yankees. They win the first pennant.
Hold the phone here. Are they, this mascot, is he entertaining the folks, or he's just hanging around letting people rub his back?
He's hanging on the bench, more of a cheerleader.
Wow.
On the bench, ready, you know, to do whatever he's asked to do. So he might do some other tasks, such as, you know, arranging bats. He's probably a secondary responsibility for him would be things like being a bat boy.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, so these aren't guys, they did not interact with the crowd. They
right.
were strictly
okay.
there for the purpose of assisting in their club winning. And winning was the key to the survival of these types of mascots back in the teens.
Wow. I'm kind of stunned.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that we've got, what happens is that mascots kind of go out of favor. They're not that popular after that. And it isn't until the mid-60s that the Mets have a Mr. Met, who has continued off and on. We're going to learn as we take a look. Now, if we took a look at the major league clubs right now, we would find 27 of them with mascots. We would find three without.
Okay.
Three without. One of them is pretty obvious, be the Yankees. The Yankees are a very traditional team that has kind of, you know, it considers itself to be, you know, a top echelon club that wouldn't need to resort to the promotional aspects that mascots provide. The other two are a little bit more surprising. One of them is very surprising. The California Angels are actually, they're called the Los Angeles Angels now. And then we've got the Los Angeles Dodgers. But we've got the other. Now, I'm not going to bore you with the going running down the 20 seven other teams that have mascots, but I think right. a couple of them are worthy of discussion because they kind of demonstrate the history and the development of what's happened with mascots. The first one I'm going to mention is the Atlanta Braves back in 1989 had started their mascot called Homer the Brave.
Huh. What's
interesting about this is that they had a mascot before that. That mascot was called Chief Nakahomer. Nakahomer.
Oh.
Ooh, yeah.
Ooh. Okay.
So this mascot, what he would do is he would, no matter what the weather was like, could be blazing hot, he was required to basically reside in a teepee out in left center field and only came out when the Braves hit a home run, and of course, and went into his war dance or whatever they would do.
Wait. He was on the field.
He actually was in center, actually beyond center field. Thank you for clarifying that. He was like in the stands or, you know, like on a perch up there beyond the outfield. So
okay.
everybody could see him do his war dance when they hit a home run. So by the mid eighties, it through pressure, this fella became sports Chief Nakahomer was considered politically incorrect.
Yes.
And was relieved of his responsibilities. I'm going to mention one that's pretty common, you know, Baltimore Orioles.
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect that the Orioles would have a bird. So they got, the typical bird head on top of a guy. And I would say that he's a good example. He came in existence in 1979. That be careful of what you do in mascots. This is not what you call a dangerous job. You're
yeah,
out there.
Sounds like it.
You could run into walls, and sure enough, the Oriole bird ended up getting pushed into an outfield fence and getting hurt. So that can happen. Now, one of the more recent mascots we've had is Clark. Clark is the Chicago Cubs mascot.
Clark?
He came into existence in 2014. Prior to that, the Cubs did not have a mascot. Now, this mascot, Clark, is a bear head on.
Oh,
I've had
okay.
the pleasure of meeting Clark and actually had my picture taken with him back in 2014. But he represents a good example of what the more traditional clubs will do if they get a mascot. Clark is not allowed on the field. Clark is not even in the stand.
Oh.
Clark is basically outside the ballpark greeting the fans as they come in. And as a greater responsibility, he goes and makes special appearances, particularly in children's hospitals. So a lot of times these mascots have a kind of a secondary role in terms of what they do at the ballpark.
They're PR
and they're
guys.
More used for promotion.
Yeah.
The Chicago Cubs, I kind of compare them to the White Sox because they just do the opposite. But before I move on to the White Sox, I just want to mention that the Cubs, quite often fans take it upon themselves to be mascots without the permission of the club.
Ooh.
And want to kind of root the team on. So sure enough, back in the 80s, there was a person who decided he was going to become Billy the Bear, who had a lunch pail, big bear head, and he got into the ballpark. And he would do various things, and the club felt that this was not their – he wasn't official. So therefore, they wouldn't allow him to come in.
Ooh.
So what they did is Billy was able to, before you had all the security measures, would kind of basically put his uniform and his head in some sort of bag or sack, sneak into the ballpark, go into the restroom, get in his uniform, and then try to continue to be a mascot. And as they raced around the ballpark, capturing him and booting him out. Well, Billy then became a outside the ballpark mascot, and sure enough, there you can find Billy at various outside the ballpark, and it's gotten to the point it's a real money making exercise for him because there's actually six guys who are Billy, and they take turns and they basically come around and they put their hands out and get money. Billy has gotten a little bit of trouble. One day he was in a bar before the game at there's a bazillion bars by the ballpark, and somebody decided to get cute and take his head off, and Billy proceeded to, basically beat him up.
Wow.
So he's yeah.
A little sensitive. A little sensitive.
Yeah, very sensitive, that mascot. That's not the only one where the heads come off, though. I'll give you a good example of another one of those. Now, the White Sox got Southpaw. He's a predecessor to Ribby and Rhubarb. He's just a typical left-handed mascot who doesn't have basically a animal or human look to him. He's exactly the opposite. He's a mascot who's going to, before the game, be on the field, rooting on the fans on. He'll be the one getting up on the dugout between innings, helping in terms of maybe throwing T-shirts to the fans, et cetera. So he's got a strong field presence. So it's just kind of give you the example of the difference between the Cubs and the White Sox.
Yeah.
I mentioned briefly just a couple more of these. Cincinnati has got the most mascots. They've got four. Mr. Red. Rosy Red, his wife. And they got a couple others too, Mr. Redlegs and the Gapper. Sometimes they take names that are animals. Sometimes they take names that are baseball terms. So
what's a Gapper?
A Gapper is like hitting a ball between two people in the outfield. It'd be like a double or a triple that goes to the wall.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's a Gapper. So Cleveland has the slider is hit, who's been there since 1990. What happens, and here's another example of politically incorrect, most people don't realize that Chief Wahoo is not their mascot.
Ooh.
Chief Wahoo has been one of these. He's probably even more blatant than the Braves Indian. Chief Wahoo is one of these, would have the war paint on with the headdress, with the tomahawk, and just had that gleeful look looking for his next victim. So he was over the edge. And so what the Indians have done is they believe it or not, they're still using him in some ways, such as maybe in print media a little bit. They've de-escalated his use to the point, based upon, protest and negotiating this and that. So that's
wow.
Kind of an interesting one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, a Kansas City Slugger, that's there's he's a lion. Slugger has one of several mascots that's been sued by fans who they get a little too aggressive and maybe hurt them, when they kind of roll around on the field. Mascots have been sued by players too. So I'll give you an example of that. Billy the Marlin. Billy is Miami. So fish makes sense. He's got a big fish head.
Yep.
The Marlins are tried to do a promotion whereby they would have Billy actually parachute into the ballpark. So what they did is they basically put a parachutist, not Billy, into that. And the promotion didn't work out too well when Billy's head flew off halfway down on his descent.
Sure. Here, you got to strap that thing on.
Yeah, you got to use something. They ought to use some doggone duct tape.
Well, yeah,
it's always good for something.
Blue of the universe.
But yes, it. Believe me, without it, I that's the only thing that makes me somewhat mechanically inclined is to have that. I mean, I hit the duct tape before I hit the toolbox. That's for
right.
Sure.
Of course.
Milwaukee, Bernie the Brewer. He's a guy who's in the back. He's never on the field. He's up in his little perch beyond the outfield. And when the Brewers hit a home run, he circles his way around a little slide and goes into a big glass of beer. So he's pretty good. I've mentioned he's kind of cute. And the fact is that he's a good mascot because I don't like these guys who kind of parade around the field and get in the way of the ball game.
Of course not.
So he mentioned Mr. Met. Now, quite often these mascots will have wives. So Mr. Met had to have a Mrs. Met. So he goes back. He's the oldest of the current, mascots. He's 1964. We got the Philly Fanatic, probably the most recognizable mascot. We got the Pirates have got a parrot because of quite often a pirate will have a parrot.
Yeah, Johnny Depp.
Yes. San Diego is interesting because quite often people associate the San Diego Chicken as being the official mascot of the San Diego Padres.
But he's not,
well,
is he?
Well, that is not. They have as a mascot called the Swinging Friar. And because Padre could be father,
sure.
his background actually goes beyond before the Met, but he was a minor league mascot when the San Diego had a Pacific Coast League team back in the early 60s. He was there. So who does he get? Who do we get him confused with? The San Diego Chicken. Now, the history on the San Diego Chicken is that he wasn't an official mascot, but what he was doing is he was making personal appearances starting back in the mid-80s with, you know, with a variety of clubs, but mostly with San Diego. So he decided to kind of part ways with his, branch out and go to minor league clubs and do that. He got sued by the San Diego Padres. They settled by having him make his outfit just a little bit different. But the San Diego Chicken is considered a real, you know, a real attraction. So quite often minor league teams will hire him to appear for just one game.
Wow.
But San Diego Chicken is pretty aggressive too. He's like, that's what makes him. He has a lot of interaction with the players. Now, you can get away with a lot more with minor league players than you can major league players. So
I would assume,
in between innings, he'd be the kind of guy who would go out and stand behind a player and mimic him, or he would, he had all kinds of little acts he'd pull on and pranks he'd pull on these players. And quite often they would, they might be a little bit rough. He ended up tumbling with a pitcher, hurting his shoulder. Of course, what happens? The chicken gets sued.
Oh my God.
Bound to happen. Got a couple, just a couple more. San Francisco has Lou, L-O-U, Seal. Lou Seal, S-E-A-L. So it's basically a sea lion.
Okay.
It's really considered one of the more popular ones. He replaced the crazy crab, which the fans hated so much, they threw stuff at that they basically had to get rid of that guy. So that kind of shows you what can happen.
The
Mariners have a moose, which has been on the DL for a broken ankle, just to demonstrate again how dangerous it is. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Cardinals, our home team, mascot Fred Bird, who is also pretty popular. He came into existence in 79. Those are the main ones. I was looking through my other list. You got a horse, you got a bald eagle. There's all kinds of, they're kind of goofy.
I have to say, John, I found that the earlier mascots were more interesting. The ones who were there purely for superstitious reasons.
That they were part of the game. I mean, you felt that they were important to the outcome.
Yes.
These other mascots are kind of superfluous. They're there to entertain the kids.
PR.
Yeah, it's all PR. It's all money. In fact, some of these mascots are part of the deal for the marketing programs of these clubs, which means that it's all back down to
money.
Money.
Wow, John.
So
I hate to get cynical with such an uplifting topic, but I like the superstitious ones better. That's one of the things I liked about reading The Natural and watching the movie is the book itself is just filled with all kinds of superstitious stuff that is like out of another world. It's pretty amazing. But I came to realize that, you know, earlier baseball, like closer to the turn of the century, was a little bit that way, wasn't it?
It was. I've got several books that deal with baseball and superstition, ritual. Players continue to live and die by the fact if they're in a hitting streak, they might not change their socks or their underwear or something.
Wow.
All batters have a certain ritual they go through in terms of the way they swing, the way they put their gloves on before they come up the bat. They'll have special walk-on music that they've picked, so that they feel good. Like, in fact, one of the Cubs have a player by the name of Ben Zobrist, whose wife is a religious rock singer, and he uses his wife's music this year he's using Benny and the Jets, sung by his wife. Last year, she has an incredibly good song. I don't know why they changed. I don't know much about it, but it sounded really nice to me. It was a big hit on the religious rock scene.
Huh.
So those are just some examples. I'm going to finish up this topic with the fact that, you know, the whole thing with mascots has now kind of taken on a new breed of mascots, which existed primarily what they call the races that they have. Now, this all starts back in the 80s when some of the scoreboards, what they would do is they would have these animated races with various either the first one that started it was
Rangers. You told me about this.
The Rangers started with just putting dots up there and showing them as a cartoon going across the screen and you know, kind of showing them as they're racing through. Now, they might have background scenes where they're coming into the ballpark and going through a finish line. So somewhere in this whole exercise with these racing on animation that's shown on the big screens, they decided, why don't we do something live action on the field?
Ooh.
And sure enough, the first team to do it was the Milwaukee Brewers, which are well noted for their their various types of sausage. The bratwurst is the big one. So what they did is they basically had what's called the sausage race. And the sausage race, they would just parade around the perimeter of the ballpark, you know, the inside on the field,
uh-huh.
and come to a finish line. And of course, one of the sausages would win. That race is by far the most popular. When you go up to Milwaukee and watch, I mean, this is something that really captures the fans' interest. There's one point of notoriety in terms of the sausage race, and that is a player decided to play a little prank on the sausages. So as they went by the visiting dugout, one of the players named Randall Simon decided that he was going to take his bat and basically take out one of the sausages. And sure enough, he lightly didn't, you know, like swing, hard swing, but hit him. And of course, the sausage kind of went along with it and fell down. Unfortunately, Randall, it was taken a little more seriously by the law authorities, and he was arrested, but eventually settled out of court. So that's a good one. I'll just mention a couple others. The Presidents were a natural for the Washington Nationals. The Mount Rushmore guys were the main ones. They basically, on their backs, they have numbers based upon their order of presidency. So you got George with one, you got Tom, Jefferson with three, et cetera. So they've increased it now. Another marketing agreement where apparently some association of presidents or whatever in D.C. decided they wanted to throw some bucks if you'll basically use the president that we're promoting, or, you know, kind of was History Month or something like that. So occasionally see guys like Cal Coolidge get in there, who maybe isn't deserved, but that's beside the point.
Right. yeah, good point.
Oh, dear. So some teams like to use old former ball players, like the A's use Hall of Famers. And so, again, I could go down and talk a lot more. There's, again, quite often these are a couple teams use hot dogs. The Reds have enough mascots that they basically can parade out their four mascots and have them raised.
Huh.
So, yeah. So pierogies in Pittsburgh, you name it. So, it's a lot of stuff. You know, mascots are a big part of the promotion of clubs now. And as much as I'm a kind of a traditionalist, which, you know, thinks in terms of, play ball. In other words, it starts on the field, it ends on the field. But it's an interesting phenomena, and it's a big business to these clubs to be able to promote and have, you know, the other thing is quite often they just use them on days that they might bring in more mascots if it's like a Saturday afternoon when kids are more likely to be at the ballpark.
Sure,
there's all
sure.
kinds of gimmicks that are used to kind of promote the club, et cetera. So as we finish up our segment here on mascots, I think a good segue for this is the fact that we're going to move on to the film portion of it. And the film that we're going to talk about, guess what the beginning of it has?
Baseball.
Baseball.
It starts out with
the theory.
Yeah.
I'll allow you to get started in terms of discussing a film which I know is near and dear to your heart. It's great entertainment, but it's much more than that. It tells interesting, rather profound story, and allows you to become educated in a way that I was educated because I knew very little. When I think of the Jewish faith, I think of just one faith.
Right.
But you continue on and talk about the movie that you chose, no pun intended here.
It's called The Chosen.
The Chosen.
Yes. Robbie Benson is the star. Rod Steiger is his father, who's a rabbi, and they're Hasidic. Their family is Hasidic, so he's not called rabbi, he's called Rebbe, and they have kind of an exalted place in their community. People come to them for advice and everything. He has a constant stream of people in and out of his little office upstairs in their house. It's fascinating. Like John said, the learning you do while you watch this movie, and they do a great job of telling a story, keeping you your interest high, and at the same time, you learn a tremendous amount about the different segments of the faith. So anyway, like John said, it starts out with a baseball, and these kids are all kind of in a sandlot, kind of a little better than a sandlot. I think it's some kind of a baseball field they have at the beginning of the thing, but it's very neighborhood oriented. It takes place in a New York neighborhood, and these guys
actually,
are warming
it's a,
up.
It's a New York neighborhood, Brooklyn, in Brooklyn, so which is a nice solid, oh. you know, Jewish oh, yeah. Community.
Yes.
God, I looked up the name of the actual community, which actually had a baseball park on it at one time. I think it's called High Hope or Hope, whatever. But the bottom line is that it does a great job with respect to setting and having the older buildings, because the setting here is in the 40s to start out with.
Oh, and they do a great job. I mean, it's the period aspect of this thing is remarkably good. And so they start out with this baseball field that they're playing on, and there's some kids warming up, and then they go, you hear somebody say, they're coming, and they show the horizon, and there's this group of young men wearing a garb that looks real different than everybody else. They're wearing Hasidic garb, which is, you know, exactly where their ancestors dressed in Poland and Russia and what have you. And remarkable looking, all kind of marching as a team almost. And then they take their places and they start playing ball. And it looks to me, John, like it's those small softballs that are kind of hard.
Yes. You know, here in Chicago, we've got the 16-inch softball, but this is clearly a smaller ball.
That was my favorite, by the way. We played with those in our grade school. I liked those. I liked those a lot. They were easier to catch, easier to throw, and it felt better when you hit one. It didn't feel like you were hitting a pillow. But in any case, it was an interesting game. And the bottom line of this game is that the head dude of the Hasidic kids is Robbie Benson plays him. And he's Danny Saunders. And he's remarkable. When he gets up to bat, their coach tells them all to back up, that this kid can hit. Everybody else has been struck out and what have you. But man, Danny Saunders gets on and he stands at the plate. And he can really hit, and he can really run too. So, like, once he gets on base, then you know the whole game kind of breaks open. The rest of the Hasidic kids kind of get inspired by him, and also the regular kids who are Jewish also, but they're Orthodox, they're liberal or whatever, but they're not heavy duty. So, anyways, Saunders and the Hasidic kids, the Hasidim, they shellack them pretty good. And at one point, they say, well, get Reuben in there. And Barry Miller plays Reuben, and that's the other main character in the movie, a kid. And he's a better pitcher. So he is kind of like a little submarine thing he throws. It's better than the other guy. And sure enough, it kind of flummoxes Danny Saunders, Robbie Benson. And Robbie Benson gets angry and ends up hitting a line drive right into Barry Miller's face. And so he ends up in the hospital, and his eye is damaged, and, you know, they become friends. I'm going to move it along because I could take forever. I could do scene by scene. I love this movie so much.
Yeah.
They become friends, the most unlikely of friends. And,
yes.
you know, and Danny Saunders is, he's got a perfect recall. Anything he reads or hears, he memorizes. He's a super intellect, super curious, but at the same time, very Hasidic, and he has to follow his father's instructions. And a lot of things happen in this movie. There's so many, there's plots and subplots and what have you, but I think the two biggest ones were the relationship between the Hasidic family and the Orthodox family.
Mm-hmm.
They are headed by men who are really more or less the same, but they're completely different in their worldviews. Saunders, who is Rod Steiger, is so traditional and volcanic in his opinions and emotional, in addition to being really smart, too. But he is a leader of people. And yet, you know, you look at who plays his dad, John?
Maximilian Schell.
Maximilian Schell, yes.
Schell plays
Yes.
Barry's dad.
Yes. And so, yeah, Ruben's dad.
Ruben's dad, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It is, he's an incredible intellect. And his whole thing is...
Right, he's a professor.
Exactly, and well-read and well-written. And he gets the... Once the war ends, he heads up the effort to get a Jewish state, Israel.
Right.
And here's where the trouble starts, is that the Rebbe doesn't believe anyone but the Messiah can form a Jewish state. And then, and he considers, if there were Orthodox Jews heading up the effort, he would be a little more kindly toward it. But these are people he considers goyim, non-Jews, Gentiles. Mm. Because they're not Orthodox. And moreover, he considers them gangsters and goons because they're terrorists, essentially, within Palestine. And so there's this big rift that happens between the families. Robbie Benson can't talk to Barry Miller anymore. You know, they're parted. And that separation between these two families is really one part of the plot. The other part of the plot is the formation of the Jewish state and everything you learn about it and, you know, the feelings of, you know, all the people involved are so strong and so powerful. And so in the end, what ends up happening is amazing. Reuben, played by Barry Miller, he ends up spending a fair amount of time over at the Rebbe's house. And he loves going to the weddings, and he was more or less accepted by the congregation there as one of them, even though he's not Hasidic and doesn't dress or look Hasidic, you know, but he is Jewish and he's Orthodox. So, okay, come on in, you know, kind of a thing. And they accept him. They have this big brouhaha over Israel. He's out. He's been excommunicated. And then Israel's formed. Then they say, okay, it's a fact now. No problem. Come on back. And he ends up becoming, he's on course to become a rabbi of all things.
Mm.
So, and Danny, the other guy, the Hasidic kid, he ends up becoming a psychologist and goes to Columbia and doesn't follow his father's footsteps in becoming a rabbi. So it's a very, very interesting thing. There's this stuff about silence. He raised his boy in silence. He wouldn't talk directly to him because he wanted him to have some suffering and feel what other people feel because he was so smart he couldn't feel. So amazing stuff in this thing. And Rod Steiger... Younger people who have never seen Rod Steiger, here's your chance. Method actor.
Well, I found, yeah.
Totally immerses himself in the parts, and he did a great job, I thought.
You mentioned the two different characteristics or the two different themes, major themes. And I was just, I think the fact that you can see the differences in these two factions of the religion, the extreme, the Hasidic versus the Orthodox, and the way that the two main characters, played by Robbie Benson and Barry Miller, Danny and Reuben, the way they interact allows you to see these differences actually played out.
Yes.
And as they go from one house to the other, you get illustrations of this. And I think the extreme illustration, which is something only Rod Steiger, Danny's father, could do, is, making him... basically not talking to his father was just showing...
Or vice versa. This, yeah.
Yes, and vice versa.
Yeah.
The other piece being, of course, learning a little bit more real live action as to how people within the Jewish faith are reacting to this. They're feeling that they need to find that promised land in the Middle East.
Yeah.
That is also a big part of it. So... Yeah, it's a very, very good movie, and it's well received. I kind of took a look and
got
and
great
saw
reviews.
That,
I think
critically there's a thing
from
called
users. Yeah, from people watching too.
Rotten Tomatoes Index gave it an 82% rating, which is considered very, very good.
Yes, agreed.
I would say that I read my favorite movie critic is Roger Ebert, and. He kind of, this is the kind of movie that basically has built up good reviews, because if you took a look at some of the earlier reviews, there were some very good ones, but I would categorize it more on the favorable to mixed review kind of at the beginning, but it's gained so much momentum just through user the movie fans, the people go see the film, that it's, I wouldn't call it a cult movie, but I would say it's a movie that's, it's really gotten a lot of momentum in terms of being considered a very, very, very good film.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The performances are great. The story's riveting, actually. It's hard not to, it's hard to take your eyes off of the screen.
It's, now, even if you're, yeah, even if you're old enough to you know, be around and a moviegoer back in the early 80s, this movie came out in 81, 82. This might have slipped by you because I was reading Ebert's article, and apparently this was not a movie that the actual film industry felt would be very successful. So as a result, it took some effort to get it out and distribute it. As a result, it had a somewhat limited distribution on the front end.
It did.
And so it's gained much more momentum through, you know, either renting it out or watching
cable.
It on TV.
Yeah.
Since then.
Agreed.
So yes, I would say that it's well worth a watch without a doubt. So
In fact, I told John, I rented it on Amazon yesterday and didn't have time to watch it. So I just downloaded it onto my iPad and I watched it this morning before we taped. And wow, I mean, it was every bit as good as I remembered. I hadn't watched it for at least 10 years, but I have seen this film now at least 4, maybe 5 times. And it was every bit as fresh and exciting as the first time I saw it, which you can't say that about many movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's timely, too, because we
yes.
have our president taking his first visit to the outside world.
Yeah, I'd just like to make a comment about Robbie Benson before we move off this movie. Now, Robbie Benson has a background of being sort of a teen movie. I would call him an idol, but the fact is that he was very, very popular in several of his movies as a teenager. And he was able to transcend, and this is an example where he's kind of going towards the adult side of it.
Yep.
But what amazed me about Robbie Benson is that sort of like, whatever happened to Robbie Benson?
Right.
What happened to him? Did he basically, was he unable to do adult roles and he just wasn't able to make that transition quite often?
Nope.
That juvenile actors and actresses just can't quite cross into the adult roles, and because they get so stereotyped or whatever. Well, Robbie hasn't been around in terms of performing that much. In fact, his biggest one was I don't forget the name of the movie. He was in an animated movie within the last 10 or 15 years where he played a villain role in it, and so he was only his voice.
Right.
But here's the bottom line. Bottom line is that Robbie Benson has had some really significant health challenges. Robbie was determined that because he was kind of at a certain point in his life, he was out of breath, this and that. He went and found out that he was in need of having open heart surgery. We're not talking about one-time open heart surgery. We're talking he's gone through 4 operations.
Wow.
His situation, personally, and his wife, considered so critical that he felt that the strenuous activity that quite often was required from acting would make it necessary for him to look at another form of work. So what he did is he wrote some and also became a teacher of acting. And he's also directed certain he's become a director mostly in the TV side of it. I saw an interview with him and Oprah where he teaches basically maybe one course here or there, but one of the places he likes to teach is University of Indiana in Bloomington. And they demonstrated how he would go in and show the kids how to do it. But he emphasized the fact that in order to be a successful director, and that's what he's teaching the whole scheme of filming, you have to be subjected to failure. Failure is an important part of your development.
Wow.
In this business. So I thought that was real good. And one of the touching things that he told is he was apparently John Ritter. John Ritter was, he ended up in one of John Ritter's last series, or one of the things he was doing, he ended up directing him. And apparently what happened was that as John Ritter was doing this rather physical scene where he would have to go up the steps, it just wasn't going right. So John was doing the scene over and over, and Ravi finally realized that this guy wasn't going to be able to do it much more because he's huffing and puffing really bad with just a little bit of activity.
Right.
So what happened was that he talked to John, and they basically were able to work around and do the scene a little bit different.
Mm.
But he never talked to him about, because Robbie had heart problems.
Yeah.
Robbie sensed something was wrong with him. But to this day, he feels bad because, you see, 2 days after that scene, John Ritter dies of a heart attack. And Robbie, in his mind, says, I should have talked to the man.
Yeah.
Should have said something. So it's kind of weighs on him a little bit. And then since then, he says, I don't hold back. If I see something, I don't hold back at all.
That's good.
I'll never do that again.
Wow.
So Robbie Benson has done a great job of transitioning from a teenage juvenile actor to a person who does a multitude of things in the entertainment industry. So I just thought it was important that we kind of give an update on Robbie.
Yeah, yeah, because I remember when I first mentioned his name to you in the movie and stuff, people, I think, sometimes in their minds get him transposed. They think of Ralph Macchio, the Karate Kid guy.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, who's a little more of a lightweight, although he was great in my Cousin Vinny. But still, you know, but Robbie Benson is a serious person, and he is a serious actor. And, yeah, check out The Chosen, and you'll figure out why they call it that. I could say no more. But sounds like our president chose to leave the White House last week and traveled. So that kind of transitions. One of the big places, one of the big goals was the Middle East. And this gets, you know, carries on right from the film we were just watching. And I think it's important, if you do watch that film, one of the big parts of it is the passion that Maximilian Schell shows during his speeches when he's exhorting his audiences to help form a Jewish state. And Never Again is like the bottom line of the chant, and they're talking about the Holocaust. And they showed film, the Eisenhower filming of the concentration camps and the piles of bodies and glasses, stuff you've probably never seen. And it's incredibly moving. And, you know, I think that's the best part of that movie is they give you that. Now, that is, if you meet people who are living in Israel or visiting here from Israel, there's something in their eyes that's different than other people, and it is that Holocaust. That's there. Mm-hmm. That's really alive in them, and that's a lot of their motivating factors for how they do things. You know, whether it's profiling at the airports or, you know, their don't take any crap from anybody kind of attitude for the whole world. And they, as a result, you know, they've probably got the top military in the world. They for sure have the top spy network in the world, and everyone, the United States depends heavily upon them, as we've discovered in the last couple of weeks as President Trump has spilled some of their secrets. Oh. Yeah. So here he is. Here's Trump going in the middle of all this. He goes to Saudi Arabia first and actually gets a good reception, gives a decent speech, too. And he has this, we're not going to do regime change. We're not going to tell you how to live, in which I like. That appealed to me. I like that speech because I don't feel like we're better than other people. And I don't think other people can follow our way of life and be happy necessarily. So, yeah, he was just.
Yeah, I think that we both have kind of lived through, you know, several episodes where we've seen this idea of trying to force feed our way of life or a certain political faction within a country. Mm-hmm. You know, we can go back to Vietnam. We could go back to Cuba, which was an abysmal failure.
Right.
And, you know, we can go to Iraq, I mean, two times. You know, we have screw up more than once.
Oh, yeah.
It's just mind-boggling the way that we've tried to conduct ourselves. It's amazing because quite often we think that what we've done is, oh, well, we'll just bring some troops over there as advisors. Well, the fact is that you just can't help it. Your physical presence, the U.S. physical presence there, it can be just that in itself can be offensive to a country where we, you know, kind of push it just a little bit too far.
Well, yeah, and what's the outcome? We create these terrorist groups. Sometimes we train them. Yeah. We don't even know it. So it's crazy stuff. So anyway, I kind of appreciated what President Trump had to say about that. There's a lot of things I don't appreciate about him, but I like that. I think that's good thinking. And there's some progressives who I like in the political scene who actually are exactly the same way. And they refer to these as regime change wars. And when you boil it down to that, it really does seem like a huge waste of time, life, and money. So anyways, he goes on to Israel. And he's good buddies with Benjamin Netanyahu. And that actually went pretty well, I thought. That was a good visit. And he had just come from talking with, you know, the Palestinian factions and brought the message mm-hmm. that, hey, Palestine's ready to recognize you guys. That's a major concession. And we don't know if they'll really do it, but that's at least what President Trump said. And then Netanyahu said, well, we're willing to talk if that's the case, because, you know, it's hard to negotiate with another group when they deny your existence. That's hard. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Jews just won't put up with. And, hey, I don't blame them. I wouldn't either.
You know, the way I look at all this is that Middle East is something that I kind of figure it's like it's a baseball game that's gone way too many innings. And I get to the point where it's just, you know, without an outcome is a problem.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
So you get so many false starts in terms of this. It seems like every president, feels he's got the solution, and he goes over there and says, oh, we've got it all worked out. And before you know it, it's not worked out. So I think Trump's more realistic
about it. He says, this isn't my job. This is your guys' job. Whatever makes two groups happy will make me happy. And that is the first time I've ever heard that.
I agree that it's a little different. Again, I've become, unfortunately, over the years, somewhat skeptical. I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, me too. I feel the same way about it. Now we enter into the last leg of the tour, where he goes to Europe. Now, here's where things changed pretty dramatically. He went to a NATO, was it a summit or something, some gathering? And not well received. He got the cold shoulder from almost everybody. I'm sure that was a harsh reality. All the things he said during his campaign came home to roost, where in the United States, everybody gives him lots of slack. No one gave him any there. And so they are uneasy about the United States. They're uneasy about him. They decided, it looks like we're just going to have to go this alone, which, frankly, is not a bad idea. Is it?
No, I think there are a couple of things. He kind of set himself up with some of his, with respect to his interaction with the Germany, the woman head of there. And I think it gets him off to a bad start as he goes.
Yeah, he refused to change hands.
In addition, that he made the campaign promise that he felt that, you know, that some of these other countries need to belly up and pay their fair share. And the fact is that, you know, they're over there. They're the ones who, you know, are doing most of the stuff. We, of course, felt, when we're getting out of World War II, that it was important for us to become more of a world leader. And as a result, we ended up paying more than these other countries. And I think what Trump is doing is he's not assessing, he's not giving them an invoice and saying, hey, pay this.
No, he can't.
Saying, you guys need to take a look at it and make some progress in terms of getting this thing squared away as to who should be financing this organization.
Yeah, it's not a bad message, actually. But, of course, they don't like it. They don't like to hear that. And the thing about Europe that's so interesting is that they're all different countries with different cultures and different priorities, and they're not at all like a United States. The European Union is nothing like a union, really. They're just not from our point of view here. We look at it differently, obviously. But anyway, so that's pretty much his tour. And there are parts of it I found interesting. And I think overall, it went better than I expected. What do you think, John?
Well, I think that quite often what we run into here in the U.S. is we hear Trump, we're just waiting for him to make some statement out of ignorance or something that's just flat out incorrect. And when we look at this tour, we're viewing a person who hasn't at this point, and I don't even know if the tour is over with, knock on wood, he doesn't. But I think he's been able to kind of show a general sense of credibility over there in terms of what he's saying.
I agree.
And I think that's a big part of it. I want to mention one other thing in terms of Israel that kind of relates back here to my where I live in Chicago.
And
the city of Chicago made just to demonstrate the respect that the Israelis have in terms of their attitude towards security, whether it be intelligence or military.
Yeah.
You know, what they did is that the O'Hare Airport was the scene of the United Airlines debacle, where they're pulling up a passenger off of the plane. So there's been a lot of
knee-jerk
reaction to that in terms of looking at, you know, who's to blame, this or that. But what came out of it just a couple of days ago, which I thought was incredibly good, is that they decided, the city of Chicago decided that they were going to hire as a consultant the Israeli Airport Authority, and I might have the name of it wrong, but basically the key player in terms of their airports.
Right.
Have them come over here and help us with respect to our security at our airport. And I thought, that was one very good move.
Oh, I think that's very smart. You know, and there are a lot of stuff like that goes on with different groups in Israel that we don't even know about, because a lot of times they don't want it known. You know, we work with them in terms of intelligence a lot, and have actually since World War II. So that's a long tradition, and the countries are very close. We're the only country in the world that Israel shares raw intelligence with, and raw intelligence means code names. You know, they get all right down to the people in live feeds on operations and stuff like that. That there's no other country that happens with. So it's important, I think, that you know, we keep that relationship with them. That's been good. That's been good for both sides, actually. So, and I'm great. I'm glad to hear your city has.
Yeah, woke up and with respect to security at the airport.
Well, their airports are extremely secure, as you might imagine.
Yes.
Yeah, they're masters of this. And people brought that up before, John. When 9/11 happened, that was one of the first things that was brought up. We should get the Israelis over here. But there was a lot of pushback from it because, you know, with the knife's edge we walked after 9/11 is security versus liberty. And what's one without the other, kind of a thing. And
well, we're always tiptoeing between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
There's that too.
As a result, we got to stay on the fence. Yeah. That's been our posture for so long, and being, you know, sort of like the mediator here. When you know, you hear what we're doing is, you know, if it's something that's going to help us, let's not get so hung up in the politics of these things. Let's do something to make it better for all of us, including, you know,
including
the world,
them.
By making these airports safe.
Now, I think that's a good thing. And you know, again, back to the other thing with Palestine and Israel. You know, I think when you make it your problem instead of their problem, that you're not helping.
Yeah.
You're not helping. You know, and they should be talking to each other and dealing with each other. And you know, it's easy to be a hothead when you've got some ameliorator in between you all the time. But if you don't, then you have to deal with each other. And so I think that's a good thing, and I hope that continues. And so anyway, there's our podcast, buddy. We nailed it. I think we covered it.
Boy.
It's done. Yeah. Everybody needs to get a t-shirt.
Here, right? The t-shirt, man.
I couldn't have done this without the t-shirt. How do you feel about that?
I totally agree.
Okay.
It's
so,
made a big difference.
They're blue, and they're not the blue that we thought they'd be. They are dark blue, but they have a nice amount of white thread in the weaving of this T-shirt where it has a nice kind of almost texture. It's like a visual texture, and the print and the colors we used actually fortuitously turned out to be wonderful, because you don't know until you get the T-shirt. And so we'd never run this one before, and I'm tickled pink, and you can get one. Shirt.thebro.show. All you need. Go get one. You need a t-shirt. Everybody has to wear clothes.
Yeah, right? And I'll tell you, you get the right t-shirt on, in the morning, it can get your day off to a great start. And I'll tell you right now, this is a strong candidate to make your day better.
I have to agree with my brother John. Well, okay, buddy. I will be chatting with you tomorrow. Good job.
Yes. With the holiday coming, and we're in the middle of it right now, so look forward to it.
All right, buddy.
So I'll be talking to you then.
Bye.
Bye-bye.